Welcome to the Lobot Lounge, the gathering place for the Gentlemen Nerds. The Gentlemen Nerds are three entertainment aficionados who know each other through various media endeavors, getting together to talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, toys, and popular culture. Many topics are discussed, so please be warned, there are the potential for many spoilers. If you like what you hear, you can listen to past shows on iTunes or on our website, thegentlemannerds.com. And now, enjoy the show. Buffy Summers, James Tiberius Kirk, The Doctor, Rick Grimes, Fox Mulder, Philip J. Fry, High Guard Captain Dylan Hunt, Quinn Mallory, Richard Cypher? Well, some of the names you just heard are no doubt familiar to our listeners. Some of them may have left you scratching your heads. Don't worry, I feel the same way. On this episode of The Gentlemen Nerds, we have gathered in the Lobot Lounge to discuss some lesser-known sci-fi and fantasy properties from television. We'll dig into our own knowledge of shows we know that might be obscure, and hopefully we'll introduce some of you to some TV shows you've never even heard of. I mean, summer is coming, and it's a good time to binge watch. So, gathered here in the Lobot Lounge with TV guides in hand are Mark Finn.
Don't call him a human. He's manimal.
Oh, Lord. The man from Atlantis himself, Aaron D'Arrive.
How do I follow that? Here, I'll do a dolphin noise.
And I'm your host and emotional touchstone, Joseph Botinos, better, stronger, and faster, here with the Gentlemen Nerds in the Lobot Lounge. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, guys.
Great topic. I'm very excited about this topic.
Yeah, it's going to be unique. I mean, there are a lot of shows out there that I think most everyone knows, but then I come to find out that, oh, you never heard of that show? I'll be honest. A lot of them, for me, were shows from my youth and my adolescence. And that's just age. Just like, you know, oh, this show was great. And people go, what the hell was that? I've never heard of that. Oh, 73? Of course I don't know that. You know, that kind of stuff.
And by the way, a nice shout out to the suggestion for this topic came to us via the Lobot Lounge. Aaron Page suggested we do obscure, beloved TV shows. So thank you, Aaron. We definitely love suggestions like that, folks. Send us suggestions for future podcasts, and yours might get chosen and talked about.
Yes, but thanks, Aaron, very much.
But be careful what you wish for.
Yes.
In certain cases.
Yeah.
So you know, again, we could go back and say, well, you know what, I like this show. So do we judge this in terms of, oh, I've never heard of that, or yes, that's a great show. I'm thinking that there are going to be a lot of shows that we're going to talk about that the three of us here gathered are going to be like, yep, know the show, or yep, heard of the show, but maybe never watched the show.
So sure, yeah, possibly.
That'll be exciting. Yep. I'm going to defer to my fellow gentlemen to start this ball a rolling, to bring up a show and let's chat about it. Let's go with Mark Finn.
Okay, I was thinking about this, and of course, the first every time this topic comes up, or some iteration of this topic comes up, my Rolodex in my head mentally just starts spinning like a dynamo, and sometimes I have trouble picking one because, you know, there's so many. But I thought of one right away this time that was a show that I was fascinated with when it came out, and it was a mid-season replacement on ABC, and it starred Parker Stevenson, who very, very old members of the Lobot Lounge will remember as the older brother opposite Sean Cassidy on the Hardy Boys Mysteries.
Yeah,
that's really all Parker Stevenson brings to the table. But the show is called Probe, and it was based on a concept that was created by Isaac Asimov, who envisioned a sort of a genius who was quirky and temperamental, and he would solve high-tech crimes. He was sort of like a House Only okay. instead of being a doctor, he was like a theoretical physicist, you know, and an inventor. And so it was conceptually, it was a cool idea. I don't think it ever made good on its promise because, and I think it's because they didn't really kind of know at the time what a high functioning autistic person looks like or someone else on the spectrum, you know, or something like that. But basically, the Parker Stevenson, played, Austin James, and, he was this, genius level guy with an eidetic memory. And he, you know, at like the first, the one I remember, watching that was, this sort of cool thing is, an episode where, the computer takes over the city, okay. you know, and he's got to like try and stop it from doing the thing that it does. Anyways, it was a really, you know, it was one of these concept shows that I don't think they knew how to actualize, and it did not last very long, only six episodes.
I can safely say I have never heard of the show.
Okay. It's a dim, like a shadow of a memory for me. Yeah. Yeah, that's a rare one.
There's of course episodes pop up on YouTube from time to time, it's worth checking out maybe just once, you know, with sort of the that's what that was, but it definitely was, I would say, a precursor to House, to the Zero Effect. Basically, it was an attempt for them to do a modern take on Holmes and Watson, without evoking Arthur Conan Doyle, and also without laying up the foundation, because, you know, this was one of the, it's 1988, so they spent a lot of time telling you what a jerk he was, but not showing you what a jerk he was. Right. And you know, Parker Stevenson was not an unattractive guy, but he basically, he spent a lot of time, like, he wore like a turtleneck and smiled a lot, and he'd like the way you knew he was like a horrible person is he'd like walk off when you were talking and start doing something else, and I'm like, yeah, it's more Reed Richards than you know.
Well, it sounds like Mr. Monk, you know, Tony Shalhoub's character.
It's from definitely a monk-esque type of character. Yeah, yeah. I've kind of thought backwards from it. I think it's the first time they tried to do somebody like that on a TV show, specifically in that form. I can't think of an earlier instance of seeing somebody that was genius and also not socially adroit. You know, in 1988, we all had to still like our heroes, you know?
Yeah.
So Probe would be my first.
Probe.
Right. That's a good one. I'd never heard of it. I had never heard of it.
Well, now, those of you playing the home game, if we stump you, remember, you have to drink.
Well, nice. I'm drinking because, well, I want to, but also.
Drink up, folks.
Because, yeah. You know what? We said sci-fi fantasy, and well, yes, sci-fi fantasy, I do like. Horror's my bag, folks. Those of you who know me. So I had to go.
We're stunned.
I know. You know what else is stunning? Red Skull lives. Anyway. Nice. No, but I had to go back to my horror roots and think really long and hard about TV shows that I liked that didn't last very long and you know, went away, I think, before your time. And I have to pick a horror series from 1987 on Fox. It was called Werewolf.
Oh, I love that show.
Oh, I remember Werewolf.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yes. And it follows the adventures of a college student who gets transformed into a werewolf. He's bitten by a werewolf. His name was Eric Cord, the character. And he spends the series trying to hunt down this drifter who is the werewolf who bit him, and by destroying him, he cures his own curse. So, you know, it's very much like an Incredible Hulk. He's going from town to town, following.
It is structurally exactly like the Incredible Hulk. Yes.
Two very, very interesting bits of note here is that Chuck Connors, the rifleman himself, plays the werewolf who sired him. And his name, the character name, was Janos Skorzeny. And those of you playing at home, Janos Skorzeny, of course, is a reference to Darren McGavin's groundbreaking, spectacular TV movie, The Night Stalker, written by Dan Curtis. And the vampire in Vegas in that TV show was named Janos Skorzeny. So it's a nice little nod to that. Nice. But yeah, they were like, I don't know, 28 episodes to 30 episodes. It was only two seasons. Yeah. But they do references to classic Universal stuff, like a pentagram on the right palm is a sign that he's about to change into a werewolf. And that, of course, harkens back to Lon Chaney in The Wolfman from 1941, when he would see the pentagram appear on the palm of his next victim's hand. The effects are pretty good. He was like a 7 foot tall werewolf in the vein of the Howling kind of werewolves, you know, with the standing up wolf snout, you know, weird monster. I liked the show, and I didn't necessarily find anything terribly bad with it. Of course, I haven't seen it in years. If I watch it now, I might be like, ooh, that's that's bad. But I remember being very entertained by it, and having this discussion makes me want to go and, you know, look up an episode or two, or at least the very first one, because I think it was like a movie length, like a 2-hour movie length, the first one. And I do not believe it ended with him breaking his curse. I think the series was canceled before we had a final episode, which here's a topic about TV. We're talking about TV here. In many cases, you'll watch a TV show and the end of the season, you go, wow, that was almost like a series finale. And I think that's because they don't know if they're getting renewed yet. So they filmed this episode where they go, well, just in case, let's wrap up whatever we can. We'll leave a little thread here and there, but let's go ahead and pretend this is the end of it. And they write this story that you're like, well, that's a really good ending to that show. And then it comes back next season. You're like, well, now where are they going to go with it, you know? Because it seems so final at the end. TV's tricky, folks. TV is there's a bubble that will burst. And when that happens, that show's gone. And
I'll tell you what I remember about Werewolf. You're right about the costume. In fact, they spent a lot. I think the budget was spent on the suit.
It looked great. It was a great werewolf.
He was a bipedal werewolf. He specifically had wolf legs, and they would always film the suit in slow motion. And I think part of it was to convey a sense of speed a la $6 Million Man.
Yeah.
But also so that it would hide some of the awkwardness of the suit, because the werewolf was always breaking down doors and coming through windows. And so those shots were always in slow motion.
Yeah.
And one of the things that that I noticed is that after a while, the mouth was almost always open whenever he was in the stunt suit. And so so by having the mouth be open, and then they do this kind of weird sound effect and the kind of sound, it would sort of hide the fact that the mouth wasn't really moving. So they were really clever with it. And if you can ever find it, you know, or see any of them, it's worth checking out. But especially the Hulk like structure, because he's being hunted. He kills his roommate accidentally, and he's being hunted by – it's either – I forget if it's a Texas Ranger or a detective. Instead of an investigative reporter, there's a cop trying to track Cord down for the murder of his roommate. And so it's a it was such an interesting premise, you know.
Yeah.
And I couldn't believe it was on TV, you know.
When he would, you know, when you say it was like the Hulk, it was literally, he would like hitchhike, you know, dun, 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 taking odd jobs. He's befriending new characters every episode. And while the werewolf, he had no control over who he kills, most of the time the werewolf would show up just in the nick of time to kill the villain of that episode, to show the MacGuffin that takes care of all the problems right then and there. And then if he has no memory of it, you know, but self-control was slowly eroding throughout the series. It was a well thought out attempt to make that kind of, you know what he reminded me of also? The storyline, the way that, because I was a big Werewolf by Night fan of Jack Russell, Marvel Comics,
totally,
Werewolf by
totally,
Night.
Totally, totally, totally.
So I could see that. And again, Netflix, I'm talking to you. I could see this to be a series. Yeah, of like, you know, this guy who's trying to break his curse and he's got to travel all over the world to find, and in Marvel's case, oh my God, Dracula? I got to go talk to Dracula? Yes, right. Yes, you do. But I'd love to see that realized, because you could bring in all kinds of supernatural elements into that. And yes. I'm sorry that the show didn't last more than two seasons. It was canceled in 88. And, you know, poor Cord is still cursed out there somewhere, folks. So, you know, be careful who you pick up hitchhiking.
Totally.
Yeah, yeah. You never nice. Know. You never know.
Yep. Yeah. Cool show.
All right, Aaron. What you got?
I have a show that I discovered when I was a kid. It would play on the Spanish channels that Ooh. I would get growing up in Brownsville, Texas. And I later found out, because it was had a Spanish title at the time, but I later found out it was called The Space Giants. Okay. And it is based on a manga called Ambassador Magma. From Japan, and it was, along with Ultraman, it was one of the first sort of live-action television kaiju shows where basically, you know, a kaiju shows up to smash Japan, and then some heroic figure, in this case, it was a gold robot named Goldar, or Ambassador Magma, as he was originally known, and based on the very famous Osamu Tezuka, who had made a bunch of different Astro Boy and a bunch of other very, very well-known Japanese characters. The show's premise is basically an alien invader named Rodak, who flies around in a big bat-shaped ship, has shown up, and he wants to take over Earth. Why? Because that's what they do. Fortunately, though, coming to Earth as well to help protect it from the ravages of Rodak is a series of robots. There was a mentor character whose name was Methuselah, and I wasn't sure whether he had built the robots or he was just a custodian of the robots, but he came along with three different robots. One was Goldar, who basically was a 50-foot golden robot with long blonde hair, and these big antenna that would stick out of his head that he could fire lightning bolts from and such. His wife, I think, companion, who was a human-sized woman in a silver suit, whose name was Silvar. And for the most part, she just sort of hung around the base with Methuselah, and every now and then she would see action. But and then they had a son, who was a young boy who became sort of the sidekick of the boy who starred in the show, named Gam. And all three of the robots could transform into rockets. I remember that was one of the cool things about the show. The boy who was the sort of the hero of the series was given a whistle by Methuselah. And whenever the boy was in trouble or would see a big kaiju attacking a skyscraper, he would blow on this whistle. One blow would bring Gam, and he would almost always have Gam with him because he was like a sidekick character. Wow. Two blows on the whistle would bring Silvar, and three, of course, was for the big man himself, Goldar. And they would have these amazing, you know, again, just think Ultraman, folks, but with a much, in my opinion, a much cooler looking robot. And it was the guys in the big rubber suits. You know, this was after the success of Godzilla and the kaiju movies. The Japanese studios realized, oh, people love this kind of stuff. Kids especially love this kind of stuff. Yeah. And so that's when these shows started. So these were the precursors to things like Power Rangers and things like that, where, you know, they're still very popular with kids. The Space Giants, you can see many of the episodes on YouTube. And be warned, these are early 60s. It premiered in 1966. Their early Japanese production of robots, guys in foam. I mean, you can see the foam rubber bending on the suits as they're fighting each other. So, you know, it's definitely cheesy, but it's fun. It's so much fun. Again, especially the amazing design of Goldar himself. Just a great-looking robot. You can just Google Ambassador Magma. And you'll see this great looking. He almost looks like the Iron Giant. But imagine the Iron Giant had like blonde hair and was gold and had antenna. He's a great looking beastie. So
I've seen that image. Could you describe him so well? That I've seen that image of the gold robot with blonde hair and antenna, and I never knew what the hell that was from. Yeah. So okay. I'm drinking.
Ambassador Magma or the Space Giants is what it was called in the U.S. TBS is the one that started showing those here in the U.S. And they were also the ones that would show Ultraman and later Inframan and such. But what a great show, especially for a kid. You know, I loved the Godzilla movies growing up. I loved kaiju movies, and so this was a kaiju show. Yeah. So I would eagerly plot myself in front of that TV and see what weird kind of rubber crab monster that Goldar was going to fight this week. So anyway, so yeah, the Space Giants. check it out on YouTube. It's a lot of fun.
All right. Very nice. There's some uniqueness right there, folks. I hope you're taking notes. I am. Mark, we're going to shoot it back over to you. You got something?
I do. Yeah. I was, when we were talking about Werewolf and Dracula, that fired a synapse in my crack-addled brain. Oh. And so this is a TV show that was near and dear to my heart. It was also an ABC series. It starred an actor who is now very problematic, but at the time he was a rising going concern. And the movie or the TV show was based on. It came out after Raiders of the Lost Ark, and so it caught a lot of flack for being the same kind of thing. I didn't care. Because I wanted more things exactly like Raiders. Tales of the Gold Monkey.
Oh, I remember Tales of the Gold Monkey.
Yes, starring Stephen Collins, who plays Jake Cutter, an ex-flying tiger pilot from World War II. Of course, the flying tigers were among the coolest planes and squads that flew in the South Pacific during World War II. If any of you guys have ever seen the old classic Warbirds with the open mouths on the side of the plane with the shark mouth and the teeth, those were called the Flying Tigers. And so what a cool premise, you know. And so he and his trusty mechanic friend Corky, I think, was his name. So they get into trouble in a post World War II environment where things have sort of settled down to kind of a general lawlessness in the area of the South Seas and the Asiatics. You know, really fun stuff. There's a dog that is Cutter's companion named Jack, and this was a really just an interesting premise for a show. It is available in bootleg quantities. I don't know why the copyrights are still weird, but there have been. Australian and UK releases that have been converted over to a Region 1 format. And here's the deal. A lot of people, this is the trivia for this. A lot of people thought that it was a Glenn Larson production, or as we used to call him, Glenn Larceny, because, you know, there was not a good idea that Glenn Larson would not try to replicate cheaply and badly on television. The guy that put it together was Don Belisario, who was the guy behind Magna PI and NCIS and a bunch of other things.
Yeah,
and it's actually
Belisario is well known as a TV creator. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's actually based. It claims to be inspired by Only Angels Have Wings, which is a Cary Grant film. And so anyways, I love the show. It was a lot of fun. It always featured, you know, smoky bars, a bunch of punching, and
a bunch of punching. That's a great recommendation for sure.
Actually, you know what? That's a great title for a series. A bunch of punching.
A bunch of punching.
Yeah. Well, and so yeah, it's it, femme fatales. You know, and Nazis. Don't forget the Nazis.
I got a better title. I just thought of it. Bunches of punches.
Bunches.
Oh,
punches.
I like that.
Yeah, TM. Bunches of punches.
TM.
So yeah, Tales, and I don't think it actually. I think it was actually just one series, if I remember correctly, or one season.
But I think I watched an episode. I remember. I know the show, but I'm not very familiar with the characters or anything like that.
So, anyways, it's a lot of fun. If you can find episodes, they're definitely worth checking out. Tales of the Gold Monkey. Nice. I didn't think I'd stump you guys with that, but I we've never talked about it. So
No. But it is obscure. Absolutely, it is obscure.
Totally.
Oh, I like it. Once again, I'm going back to my favorite genre, just because that's who I am. But I just, you know, we talk about TV shows, and while a lot of people probably knew that this show was out there, I've not met a lot of people who watched it. So I'm going to open with this. Louis Vendredi made a deal with the devil to sell cursed antiques, but he broke the pact and it cost him his soul. Now his niece Mickey and her cousin Ryan have inherited the store, and with it, the curse. Now they must get everything back, and the real terror begins.
Anyone? Friday the 13th.
Yep.
I am familiar with it. Which, given what Friday the 13th, the movies are about, I thought the concept for this show was genius.
It really was.
A store of cursed items.
It was originally,
and each one has a story.
It was originally going to be called something else. It was going to be called like Friday's Curse or something like that. But Frank Mancuso Jr., who of course is Paramount's gatekeeper of the Friday the 13th movie series, thought no one's going to watch it unless there's a name that they know. So yeah. He tagged on and even used the font from the movies on this show. And people would tune in and go, well, where the hell is Jason Voorhees? Well, he's not in it, folks. He's not in it.
Yeah.
But
it was great. What a great idea for a show.
I did. I enjoyed the hell out of that show. Because I remember, like, there was one episode called Kid Gloves Do No Harm. It was about a surgeon who had purchased these lambskin gloves from the antique store. And he was a doctor. And if he touched somebody who had a disease, the gloves would absorb the disease. And the gloves would look like it. Like, you'd look at... You know, it would be all leprous and diseased looking. The gloves would. But he had to get rid of it. He had to get rid of it within 24 hours or he would get it. So then he had to go and touch somebody else, some healthy person, and transfer the disease to them, to clean it. Almost like the Sin Eater. You know, he had to get rid of it. I remember that so vividly. The whole glove thing. But there was every week, folks, there was an object that had to be found and the story behind it. Was always compelling. They had to track it down. Oh, and they had this book, you know. Oh, yeah, we sold this to this guy, you know, and they had to go find him. And what a great concept for a show. Really, just really good stuff. And it was only
on. By the way, I tuned in thinking it was going to be, okay, so they're going to explore Jason Voorhees' past and then when I saw what the show was, I was like, oh, holy cow, this is freaking great.
Well, unlike Freddy's Nightmares TV show, which was on about the same time, which literally had Robert Englund as Freddy Krueger doing the horror host bit, introducing stories, sometimes appearing in them, sometimes not. This was completely different. So we had a Friday the 13th TV series and a Nightmare on Elm Street TV series on around the same time. Yeah. But in my opinion, this was the superior show because it was unique. It was original. They had all kinds of really, really interesting, malevolent entities that would be generated from these artifacts. Pirates and spirits and creepy dolls.
Which, by the way, and not a coincidence, another one of my favorite shows, which has the same kind of conceit, is Warehouse 13. And it's exactly for that reason. They went out and they acquired cursed items and brought them back and stored them. So I was like, there's something about that idea. Here is a place, a repository of some sort of cursed items from around the world.
See, I kept thinking, I watched it too. Of course, it was a syndicated series. And so, you know, you always had to kind of look because sometimes it would move. I kept thinking, I initially tuned in as well. Friday the 13th series sounds great. And then I saw the premise and was absolutely charmed by it. But I kept thinking at some point in time that they were going to have to go find the hockey mask.
Hockey mask, yes. That's what I was going to say. That was the rumor. That was the rumor. In Fangoria Magazine, a dedicated reader, by the way, subscriptions are available again, folks. Anyway, in Fangoria, they talked about that. They talked about the idea that Mancuso eventually wanted to work in and like either have the hockey mask in the store or have them go out and try to find it or something like that.
I'm actually stunned they didn't.
There was
never an episode with a hockey mask.
Or optionally, the machete would have been a thing, you know.
Wow, that's a gimme, man. That's an obvious one. You
know, if Jason used the same machete every time, but obviously he didn't. It was the hockey mask, which, okay, quick overview. He gets the hockey mask from Shelley in part three, this practical joking kid who tries to scare someone by wearing the mask. Jason kills him and takes the mask. Done. That's it. He's branded. He carries that mask with him all the way through part seven when it's destroyed by the telekinetic girl, Tina. Then he picks up another hockey mask from this guy who's also, quote unquote, trying to scare his girlfriend with the Jason story. And this guy, this guy's hockey mask is like a cosplay hockey mask, including the axe wound on the side. He does everything right. So it fits Jason perfectly. You know, So he does get a couple of masks in the film series, but that would have been such a nice touch to do that, you know, to be able to bring that out. And there's a website, folks, if you're interested in it, to find is a list of all the cursed artifacts and the episodes, corresponding with it. It's like a little checklist and you can go through them. But I recommend it. It's fun. It's a good bingey kind of a show. It's dated. Okay. It's 87. Yeah. Come on. So Roby's got the amazing flaming red hair.
Big red hair.
A lion's mane of hair. But it's,
I'm going to see if I can stump you guys.
Okay.
There was the earliest version of this setup. Okay. Was actually a radio play. It was a radio show that was a BBC series that was only around for a year, a full season. It aired, I think, in the early 50s. I want to say 50 to 51, 51 to 52, something like that. It starred Orson Welles, and it was called The Black Museum.
Ooh. Oh, yeah. No, I've never heard of it.
No, this is it was a radio show that Welles was the he produced it and was the host, and the whole conceit is is this guy walking through the Tower of London in Scotland Yard, and picking up various objects stored in its dark. The Black Museum is like a real thing.
It is, and so the Scotland Yard Crime Museum.
Yeah, and so it was sort of based on real life cases, he'd pick up the object and talk about its significance, and then that would lead us into the episode. For one thing, it's Orson Welles being Orson Welles, so you can't go wrong with that.
Right.
But it's a really good series of radio plays, and they're wonderful get in get out episodes that all foment around these spectacular objects that were found at crime scenes. So
talk about something that's just it's tailor made for a show like this of any kind. I mean, the fact that there's not a dozen more like that is the surprising thing. It's like you take a cursed object, whatever it is, and then you have a story around it. You know, that talk about that is the setup for an anthology.
From the 13 Ghosts of Scooby-Doo, you know, on, it's the idea that we have to get all these things back. You know, they've escaped from Pandora's box in a way, and we have to get them back. Black Museum, 1959, there was a movie with Michael Goh called Horrors of the Black Museum. And he had this museum of crime things that he would, I think he was a writer and he was getting either an assistant or a friend he was hypnotizing to go and use them. And the most unique piece of that was the binoculars with the spikes that would come out of the beauty
eyes. Oh, my God, yes.
You forgot. Put them up to look, and when you would adjust it, these spikes would shoot out of the eye things into your eyes.
Nice.
Yeah, that's that. I remember that vividly. And
very cool.
Yeah,
very cool.
Ugly stuff. But that's, Friday the 13th. So fun.
Nice. Yeah. So let's see. real quick, what do I have? Oh, I know one. It was called The Storyteller. And it was a series that had Jim Henson. They did all of the creature models and puppets for it. It aired in 1987, and it was actually executive produced by Jim Henson. And it had one of my favorite actors, who's now has left us, John Hurt. Was an old storyteller who would sit by a fire, and he had a puppet dog. He had a puppet dog that would sit there, and he would tell you old European folk tales.
Son oh my God!
Bitch. Yes.
Did you guys remember this?
I do.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. They did a bunch of different stories, all very well known. German and Celtic and various British folk tales, and so well done. And almost always there was some kind of puppet or creature. That was done by Jim Henson's Creature Shop.
Yes,
and it was really well done. The production values were very good, I was just charmed by it. They did a spinoff that was just about the Greek myths, that one is also really really good. That one instead of John Hurt had Michael Gambon. Was sort of the storyteller in that one, but had the same dog. He had the same dog, mind you, but a different storyteller. Lots of different Greek myths were done. They did Theseus and the Minotaur. They did Perseus and the Gorgon, Daedalus and Icarus. And I mean, just again, and it's one of those things where we saw them. They were available on, and I'm trying to think if we saw them on Hulu or Netflix. I don't remember. And I don't know if they're still available, but that's one of those things where we sat down, we binged the whole season when we discovered them. They were just charming and well done, very well acted, but absolutely worth checking out. If you can find them, they're called The Storyteller. Mm-hmm. They are spectacular, and I highly recommend that our listeners go and find them somehow. I don't know. Have they been released? Let me look here. They might have been released on VHS.
Yeah,
That's a lot of the problems with this, by the way, which, you know, Mark, you were going to address. But a lot of times, old series, the rights get tied up somehow. There's fights over them. Somebody sits on the rights, whatever it is. But according to this, there was a DVD release in 2006 where they released Jim Henson's Storyteller, the Definitive Collection. And then after that, I do not see. There was some books written about it. There were some graphic novels also. Apparently it won an Emmy Award in 1987 for Outstanding Children's Program. So, no, this is, we're talking quality stuff, folks. This is cool. This is unlike Ambassador Magma / Space Junk, it's cheesy. this is quality stuff. I mean, almost movie budget for these episodes, and really, really well done. So.
Oh,
definitely.
Yeah, that's great. Would you call it a children's show?
I would. Some of the tales are a little spooky. I mean, I don't know that they're appropriate for, you know, maybe like a 5-year-old. But you know, I mean, Elena saw them when she was like 7 or 8 or so, and she loved them. She loved them. I mean, you know, they have the, like all good fairy tales do. They have a darker aspect to them.
Yeah,
but it's definitely family friendly. It's definitely family friendly. So
nice. Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to turn this table around for one more round before we get into some more deeper discussion about availability and the shows themselves and the people who love them. We'll go another round if that's okay with you, gentlemen. I'd like to hear more. I'd like to learn more. Mark, what you got?
Well, this is actually one that I have been. This is my grail. Okay. This is my grail because I remember seeing the show in the listings, but I was never able to find it because it kept moving around.
That's never a good sign.
No, yeah. It wasn't a good sign, and I think it was terribly ambitious for the time. But it was called Cliffhangers. Okay. And what it was a series that aired. It predates Raiders of the Lost Ark, and there were three serials that would run in 20-minute episodes in this hour-long program. Okay, There was a Brenda Starr kind of female a reporter. And that was called Stop Susan Williams. There was an old West weird Western thing called the Secret Empire, and it's of course very much the Secret Empire with the underground civilization run by aliens and stuff like that. And then the third one was called The Curse of Dracula.
Ooh.
Uh huh. Have I got your attention now, fellas?
Okay. Certainly, Joseph's.
It's literally Michael Norrie plays Dracula, who is a college professor in San Francisco, and he is secretly Dracula.
Oh,
nice. And so it was like modern day Dracula, weird Western, lost race story, and then investigative reporter that gets into trouble, perils of Pauline kind of a thing. This was the premise, and it ran for I think one season, which was 12 chapters. I forget exactly what how it all kind of shook out. It may not have ended, but it was one of these things that I've heard about. I've never seen it. And the people that remember it remember very fondly one or, you know, the other one, but they don't remember the other two of the thing. So they're like, oh yeah, I love the reporter, or oh, the Dracula thing was awesome, but I didn't like the Western, you know. It's called Cliffhangers, and it was a crazy, crazy weird experiment. Now you look at it and you go, yeah, that'd probably fly. I mean, you know, if you did that kind of a take as a Netflix series or something like that, because they were 12 1-hour episodes, and each thing picked up the vibe, and they were almost the same length as a serial chapter, you know. Anyways, nice. Cliffhangers. Yeah. Nice.
Cliffhangers.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And it by the way is not available. it's a real hard to find.
Not even on YouTube.
Not even the old underground tape railroad. People did not have this thing. Yeah. Interesting. Very nutty.
Huh. All right. Well, noted. I've been saving this one. This is my mic drop. I don't get any better than this.
Here we go.
I grew up watching the show, and it may have affected me. I know certain parts of the show affected me. The year was 1976, and Sid and Marty Krofft decided to do live action. And they did a lot of those live action shows, you know, Sigmund the Sea Monster, H.R. Puff and stuff, et cetera, et cetera. But I was drawn to this little variety show that they had called the Krofft Super Show. And on this Krofft Super Show from 76 to, 78, something like that, they had multiple episodes of stories, like, you know, episodic 15-minute bits. They were all tied together with a glam band called Captain Cool and the Kongs. And Captain Cool and the Kongs. Oh, stay with me. Captain Cool and the Kongs, this wacky glam rock glam band, that actually all their songs were written by Donny Marie Osmond, frankly, and they were backup to Donny Marie before they were replaced by the Bay City Rollers in their show. Anyway, I digress. So Captain Cool and the Kongs introduced shows. Now, you probably have heard the shows. I guarantee you've heard of Dr. Shrinker.
Oh, yes.
Electra Woman and Dinah Girl.
Yes, of course, of course. And Shazam.
Wonderbug, Magic Mongo, and of course, Bigfoot and Wild Boy.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Those were the shows that were on the Croft Super Show.
And oh, but like, not Isis and Shazam?
No. Isis and Shazam Power Hour was a separate show.
Okay.
These things appeared on the Croft Super Show. Briefly, just God, I love Dr. Shrinker because I had a great theme. He's a madman with an evil mind.
Dr. Shrinker, he's a madman with an evil mind.
Yep. And it was Jay Robinson as Dr. Shrinker. Billy Barty was his little creepy assistant. Love Billy Barty. Yep. And they were, you know, this mysterious island and these teenagers, there's always teenagers who are the heroes here, and they get stranded on the island and Dr. Shrinker shrinks them and they escape in miniature form. And the whole series is them running around in miniature form, trying to escape Dr. Shrinker and Billy Barty. Electra Woman and Dinah Girl was my first exposure to pulchritudinous women running about in lycra and spandex. Mm-hmm. So it made me feel funny in certain places. I was a fan of Electra Woman and Dinah Girl only because they would run in slow motion, like towards the camera, you know, Electra Woman and Dinah Girl. Yeah. And they're just bouncing through my Saturday mornings as I eat my cereal. Wonderbug. Again, three teenage friends who fix up an old dune buggy and they put a magic horn on the car that comes to life as Wonderbug. And this Wonderbug could fly and they fought crime and it was something special. Magic Mongo was a genie story. They found, again, a bunch of teenagers. You see here I'm going from?
Yeah, yeah.
Teenagers, they find an old bottle and they have wacky adventures. When they rub the bottle, a genie appears and they get magic things. And then Bigfoot and Wild Boy. There was literally a boy orphaned in the Pacific Northwest and he was found and raised by Bigfoot.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's Croft Super Show. I mean, I don't know if it's out there. I hope it is. It's one of those things that is embedded in my brain, especially Shrinker, Electra Woman and Dinah Girl, and Bigfoot and Wild Boy. Yeah. I seem to have dismissed Wonderbug and Magic Mongo, probably for the best. Probably for the best. I don't need to think about those teenagers and their flying dune buggy. But but I love watching Bigfoot and Wild Boy because they would run in slow motion, like the $6 Million Man, like my favorite guy, Steve Austin. You know, and I guess that must have been they were moving fast or something. But yeah. But yeah, if you can, and I don't even know if it's available, I'll have to look this up. But the Croft Super Show. And then they had a Croft Super Power Hour where they kind of pulled these episodes and mixed them in with – that's maybe, Aaron, what you were thinking of when Shazam and Isis they would mix those things up. Because they had this plethora of entertainment, a library of shows to pull from and tie together. But Sid and Marty Croft ruled my Saturday mornings in a great way.
Totally.
Yeah. So there you go. That's my really obscure thing that most people – deny it existed when I describe it to them. They go, no.
Oh, no, I remember every single one of those that you mentioned. Bigfoot, absolutely. Wild Boy, Electra Woman, and Dinah Girl. I mean, come on. You could not have grown up in the 80s watching cartoons and not have seen one of those shows. I mean, it's just...
Captain Cool and the Kongs, though, man, that's one of those, like, I'd love to see, if they went on tour and the Banana Splits opened for them, I would go.
Yeah, I don't know how much I would be willing to pay, but I know that I would be paying it.
Nice. All right, awesome. Well, okay, well, I will throw out an animated show as my last choice. I'm a big fan of cartoons growing up, as probably most kids are. Of course, now there's no Saturday morning cartoons anymore, really, but now with Cartoon Planet and Disney XD and all that, I guess you don't need Saturday morning cartoons, but it's I'm sad. I'm sad that tradition is gone. Mm-hmm. But there was an animated show that came out in 1991. So this was much, much after I had stopped watching Saturday morning cartoons, but it was so well done. It was called The Pirates of Dark Water.
Yes.
It was amazingly well done for the time where a lot of the cartoons, in my opinion, were starting to feel the same. Here came something that was a little off the beaten track, you know, presented a whole new wonderful fantasy world, the world of Mare, where basically everything's an island. The entire world culture exists on ships, and they sail from island to island, you know, going about and doing various piratical activities. So I thought for sure Joseph must have been a fan of this show. Created by the same individual, which I love, David Kirshner, who did the Chucky movies. That's what pretty much he's known as, the creator of the Chucky movies. He was the creator of this, and I just, the concept is there was an alien world that's being attacked by something, a black substance called dark water, and it moves around like the, much like the black symbiote in Venom. So these ships sail around and doing their thing. The villain is this great character named Bloth. And he's this big pirate captain that pirates the ship, the Maelstrom. And he is the chief antagonist to our hero, Ren, who basically they're after the lost treasures of this world. There's the 13 lost treasures of Rule is what they're called.
There you go. MacGuffin time.
What now?
I said MacGuffin time.
Yep.
The 13 MacGuffins of Darkwater.
Correct. And so it's just so well done. They introduced the idea, which I love, of an ecomancer, a character named Tula, and worked with the substances of the planet. So Tula could create biological weapons, and they had bombs that were made out of things like they would throw these beehives, and those were their weapon, the bombs. They would throw things that would latch onto the mast, and they would secrete acid. They were living, and the mast would start to crumble and fall. And again, just so many really inventive new things that I hadn't seen. And of course, pirates. Oh my God, it's cartoon pirates.
And it's very unique in their styling and their decoration. They didn't look like your traditional Caribbean pirates. Obviously, they had a little bit more fantasy, futuristic yet retro look to them. They were all across the board. Like it looked like what's his name? I want to say kind of like Dark Crystal, but not really. Dark Crystal and Waterworld, mix them together.
Dark Crystal is, I think, an excellent comparison. It had that, like Dark Crystal, which was such a beautifully realized fantasy world.
Yeah.
Dark Water had the exact same vibe to it. Like somebody sat down and really thought about this.
Yeah.
And make sure everything had a certain look, a certain feel. But Dark Crystal is a very good example. Yeah, Dark Crystal meets Waterworld.
And this was the era, of course, in the 80s that, a lot of these cartoons were created with the idea that there was going to be a toy line attached to them. And very much like Masters of the Universe, G.I. Joe, Transformers, etc., the Pirates of Darkwater had a toy line as well. And you could get the action figures from the Pirates of Darkwater. So, Aaron, I know what I'm getting you for Christmas.
Oh, good. Yeah, excellent. I loved this show. Whenever it would come out, I would record it on VHS, and I'd come back, and I was probably off at school at that point, college, and I would come back and watch them. And I thought, you know what? Gosh, if I had had this show when I was a kid, I would have lost my shit. I would have loved this show.
Yeah.
But very much showing. And that's what I enjoy about it, is that it was showing kids, hey, you know what? Really stretch your imagination. Whatever you come up with does not have to look like the other stuff that you watch.
Yeah.
Make it new. Make it different. Make it feel like a completely alien world. So I was very, very much a fan of Pirates of Dark War. And I looked this up earlier. I don't know. Again, and we're going to talk about this in a little bit. I don't know if it's available on any kind of home media. There was apparently a 2010 release of it. I don't remember seeing it. I would have bought that thing if I'd seen that. Yeah. And that was a DVD. I don't know if it's been released since then, like on Blu-ray or anything like that. In fact, I'm probably going to look it up on Amazon after this. But there was also, they did video games based in the world.
They did. Yeah.
And apparently those did okay. But yeah, I am a huge fan. I am a huge fan of Pirates of Dark Water.
I want to say a few years ago, it was, maybe five years ago, the Hanna-Barbera started releasing a lot of their series in called the Hanna-Barbera Classic Collections, and the Pirates of Dark Water came out all 28 episodes on a Hanna-Barbera release.
So
it's available. It's available.
Okay. It's called Hanna-Barbera Classic Collections?
Yes, Hanna-Barbera Classic Collection. Okay, and they got the complete series.
I'm writing that down. That sounds, I will buy it. I will buy it. It is, and shows like this, by the way, folks, I encourage people, if you have a beloved show like that is released on Blu-ray, DVD, whatever, purchase it because they will become little treasures. We're about to transition into, you know, that very topic. What happens in an age where either you can see anything you want sometimes on YouTube or the internet or whatever, but sometimes these things just disappear. You know, rights again become battled over, and somebody sits on it, and that's it. You know, somebody might have a VHS or something, but
yeah, it's hard to see. During pre-show, we discussed the topic or the phrase cult classic, and I want to bring this up because a cult classic really is something, typically a movie, a book, whatever, that's popular or fashionable among a particular group or section of society, which classifies it as a quote-unquote cult classic. But it also can be that particular group or section of society that knows about it, that has access to it. And access is important. And Mark Finn's question originally was, in today's digital age, are there cult classics anymore? And I would argue, my answer to it, a brief and short answer, is yes. There are some really obscure stuff. Somewhere out there, folks, somewhere out there, there's a guy or a girl who's got a bootleg ripped CD with all the songs of Captain Cool and the Kongs. Right. That person's out there. Yeah. That makes that pretty cult. You know, it's a small section of people who like jam out to that and go, this is my jam. This speaks to me. And I think if you meet like-minded people, however small that group, you create that cult. Right. And cult in this instance, folks, is not a bad word. It's not a scary thing. It's not, you know, ooh, Satan. It's meant to be that small group of like-minded individuals enjoying something that's not widespread.
And you know, I'll give you an example of something I think that was a cult classic, still is a cult classic. You go to conventions, you can buy it. And that is the Star Wars Christmas special.
Oh, God.
No, but that is, it is a great example of it aired once. After that, Lucas was like, oh, my God, let's pretend this never existed.
Yeah.
And fans loved it so much. Certain fans loved it so much that they started reproducing it and selling it, bootleg versions, at conventions. I remember going to conventions early on. We're talking about the 90s, and seeing, like, oh, you know, that merchant has one, or that vendor over there, they have a. Now everyone, if you go to a convention and they're offering DVDs or Blu-rays or whatever, one of them will always be the Star Wars Christmas special. I mean, that's just how it works. but that's an example, I think, of what you're talking about, Joseph, where before you had to look for it, you had to know who to go to, what to ask for, who to see. And now, you know, depending on how popular something has become, and that's the other question, right? When something becomes so popular, is it no longer a cult classic? If everyone wants to get their hands on it, is it no longer a cult classic? It's by definition cult, meaning it has to be a limited audience.
Well, this would be my contrarian answer.
Okay.
Which is that I think the era of the cult classic is largely over. Okay. And it's because while there's things out there that we don't have access to, cliffhangers being a great example of one, or whatever, there are, and there's certainly groups of people that want these things
and they have not been released. Joseph, you and I both know that there's a ton of horror from the 1980s that exists only in VHS format, right? So that has not been converted or gotten a conversion. Right. Well, I would suggest that part of what made a cult classic was intention. You had to find out about it. Fangoria was the Bible for horror movies and making us aware of things that, and then we had to go and find them, like Pieces, the Spanish slasher film, right? I saw the write-up. I saw the write-up in Fangoria, and I had to go find it. Yeah. The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, which had a limited theatrical release, and then almost immediately became a midnight movie that ran on the convention circuit for years and years. And so you had to be in a college town, know when they were showing it, show up to the thing. You know, there was it required active participation on your part, and that was the only way you knew if other people were into it like you were. You'd walk in and all of a sudden you're in a room of the same people full of Buckaroo Banzai fans who know the quotes like you know them. Mm-hmm. That to me was how things became cult classics. Rocky Horror Picture Show is a great example. And I think that the digital era and the ubiquity of Amazon and certain DVD releases has blunted the impact of these cult classics. And when you can watch Rocky Horror Picture Show in your living room with your wife and your kid, and there's subtitles across the bottom that you're supposed to say, but you're not really saying it out loud because it's just the three of you. Well, guess what? That's not the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Mm-hmm. The Rocky Horror Picture Show has to be in an audience with their specific references. Mm-hmm. You've got to have a squirt gun and a newspaper. You know, these sorts of things constitute what women went into a cult classic. And I think that that the internet has largely wiped a lot of that out.
I'm going to use Buckaroo Banzai on this because I think that that's a fine example, because Buckaroo, as we've had discussions, the three of us online, etc., it's not everyone's cup of tea. Some people go, oh, that's a little whatever. You know, it's all, oh, it's so wonderful and so unique and special. And while I adore the film, I know some people who do not. Now, I think a cult classic, and I'm going to be contrary to your contrary, is about intention from the person enjoying the media. In other words, that's for me. And I would guess that the Buckaroo Banzai crowd is not as large, even though it's completely widely available now. You could find it anywhere. You could download it. You could watch it. It's easy to find. But not a lot of people will watch it. And I think that makes it cult more than the accessibility of it.
Right. All right.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. And even like it's so funny. As you guys are talking, I'm on Amazon, and I'm typing in, okay, let me see, cliffhangers, TV series. Not available. Werewolf complete series. Oh, look, something popped up. There it is. Werewolf, the complete series, format DVD. Oh, not currently available. Ooh. So I think I actually fall on Joseph's side on this. There are still, although admittedly, fewer and fewer, but there are still those TV shows, those movies, you know, the big thing now, and you can now, this you can find on YouTube, but a lot of unaired pilots. I am a fan of watching unaired pilots. The network ordered them, they were made, they saw them, they went nope, and they did not go to series. There are dozens of unaired pilots, folks. You can get online, go to YouTube and look up unaired TV pilots.
Huh. And you can also have the joy of being a TV executive and going, oh, I can see why that didn't get picked up.
Yes, yes. No, it's true. It's true.
Well, that's a no from me, folks.
I recently saw, I think there was a Wonder Woman unaired TV pilot. And I kept wondering,
Adrian Padalecki or what?
How bad could it be? How bad could it be? Well, I saw it and I went, oh, okay.
And the answer is none. None more bad.
I think I can see why a network executive looked at another one and said, no, we'd be insane to put this on our network. But, you know, that is where before the ubiquity of the internet, you would never have, you know that they existed, you know, somebody somewhere, oh yeah, I was in a pilot that never aired, you know, an actor would talk about it or whatever. And you're like, well, where do I see these? Where do I watch these? Well, get on the internet, get on YouTube. And, you can see a bunch, you may not want to, but you can see a bunch of unaired pilots. So again, that's where, like, I'm, you know, like, yes, I see Mark's point where, you know, before there would be a cult group that would do nothing but watch unaired pilots. That's what they would do. They would have parties and get together at people's houses, and the guy would hold up the VHS tape triumphantly. I got it, guys. I got the unaired Wonder Woman pilot. Yay! And everyone would sit down and watch it. Now it's like, oh, yeah, have you seen it? Well, here, let me send you this link. And so now they can watch it. Now they can watch it. And so, okay, yeah, you're right. I can see why that's bad.
Right.
But there are, because now, of course, YouTube is, who bought YouTube? Was it Amazon? Somebody bought YouTube. Mm. And so they have scrapped a lot of that. There used to be all kinds of episodes of stuff you could see on there.
Yeah.
And now it's like, nope, removed at the request of this network studio. And
that is true.
And so I think now, it's getting harder to find a series, an unaired pilot, some old TV movie that you know you loved as a kid and can't find, and nobody really knows. But you have more of a chance to find it certainly than you did, you know, in the 80s or 90s or. Mm-hmm. I'm torn. I'm torn. I think certain cult classics have been destroyed by the ubiquity of the internet. Others, I think, remain, and that's because either the crowd is so small, you know, the group that loves this stuff is so small that nobody cares enough to actually make the effort. Mm-hmm. Once something becomes so popular, if everybody loves Buckaroo Banzai, is it a cult classic? No, it's not. No. It's no longer a cult classic.
Mainstream.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's where I fall. I obviously, you know, I said it already, but I think that has a lot of weight about what makes something a cult. Hey, I have this group, and we go around and we put fried chicken on skewers, and we leave them in the street. That's what we do. Oh, really? That sounds fun. How many people are in that? About 15, 16. You want to join? Nah, not really. Not into that. Not into that cult. You know, the level of interest, I think, is really hugely important in that. And, you know, hey, you know what else is kind of a cult classic? There's this great podcast called The Gentleman Nerds. And you should listen to these three guys. They get together and they talk about all things nerdy, mostly in the vein of film, television, TV show, movies. Have you heard the show? No, I haven't, but I'll check it out. Oh, good. Please do.
Yeah.
make us mainstream.
Yeah, not make us classic. Not a cult classic.
Right. Yes, that would be great. I want to be ubiquitous.
Yes, yeah, that's exciting. The ubiquitous Mark Finn. I can right. introduce like that. You that way all the time. All the time. Well, this has been fun. We're getting a bit of a pink eye from Maximilian, so I think we're going to start wrapping up. Do you guys want to do just mention brief, ever so briefly, a last parting TV show? Can you guys dig deep for that?
Yes.
Yeah. No, right. In fact, I have a few that I obviously didn't get to, but I did want to throw out there. So just rounding out my trio here, there's another similar to Storytellers called Fairy Tale Theater.
Yes.
Starring Shelley Duvall.
Duvall.
And I think those were a really wonderful set of well-told fairy tales. Again, similar to Storyteller. There is a British show called Jekyll, which is really well done. It's a modern-day Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. And it is just so well done. We saw I think there's maybe there's just one season, maybe there's two seasons. Anyway, it's called Jekyll. It was a BBC production. It's really solid. And then lastly, I want to mention Robin of Sherwood, which was Robin Hood show made in the 80s. Again, a British production. It is dated. It is dated. Ugh. But if you love Robin Hood, that is definitely something worth looking up. Robin of Sherwood, which is a BBC production made in the 80s. So those are mine.
Nice. All right. Mark, what you got?
Well, I want to do a quick shout out for the company, the Shout Factory, and their sister company, Scream Factory. Yes. This is currently one of the two or three places that is doing really nice digital cleanups of a lot of these 80s VHS classics and obscure horror and obscure TV shows. Their line of stuff is really good. They have great production values. They put a lot of work into their restorations, and they go and get new interviews, and they make new featurettes. They're a really good company.
So
if you haven't, if you guys haven't checked them out, they're totally worth looking at. Scream Factory in particular, if you like horror movies. But I will just drop a real quick my final show, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.
Yay!
Oh yes.
It's a great weird western with steampunk stuff happening. It was doomed from the start.
Yep.
There wasn't a way in hell that this could have continued past its initial inception.
It's true.
Stars Bruce Campbell. Is a wonderful, wonderful show. It's actually, it has finally been made available on the DVD. So, totally worth checking out, especially if you're a steampunk / weird western / Bruce Campbell fan.
Yeah.
Totally, totally fun stuff. Great.
Great choice.
I'm going to pop out two quick titles based on our discussion of Saturday morning TV. Cause gosh, darn it. There was so many good things there. My first is sci-fi. It's Jason of Star Command.
Oh, yes.
I recommend Jason the Star Command. It was a Filmation TV series from 78. And you could look at it and go, oh, that, is he trying to be Han Solo? The answer is yes. Yes, he is. And so a lot of fun. Sid Haig as the evil Dragos. You can't beat Sid Haig at chewing scenery on Saturday morning live action children's shows. And of course, I've mentioned this show before on this podcast, but I cannot scream its praises enough, and that is The Hilarious House of Frightenstein, a Canadian children's TV series, which was like a children's monster laugh-in, with Vincent Price introducing segments, and the amazing Billy Van as every conceivable character in that show. He played everyone.
I have since gone and watched some of those. They are fun, fun, fun.
Yes, yes. Yep. Love it. The Hilarious House of Frightenstein. Well, folks, thanks for hanging in, and thanks for listening. The Gentleman Nerds is a Cloak & Dagger production and is written by Aaron D'Arribe, Mark Finn, Ben Gibbs, and Joseph Fortinos, with additional material by Joss Whedon and Rob Serling. Music composed and performed by the amazingly talented Ben Gibbs. Promotional material, logos, and the Gentleman Nerds mascot, who is still nameless, created by artistic goddess Michelle Fitzpatrick. The Lobot Lounge bouncer is Maximilian, and our special guest bartender tonight was Guinan. Thanks, Guinan. Our sound editor, mixer, and intentional producer is Ben Gibbs, our executive producer, and a man we all pray never, ever, ever get superpowers is Aaron D'Arribe. The Gentleman Nerd's attorney is Dr. Gonzo. High Guard Captain Dylan Hunt is from the TV show Andromeda. Quinn Mallory is from the TV show Sliders. Richard Cypher was from the TV show Legend of the Seeker, and Mark Farnash is the man in the gorilla suit. Web hosting by Rustix Interactive. Technical assistance provided by Blythe Christopher D'Arribe. Please join us in the Lobot Lounge online, please, on our Facebook page, and when we next open here on Podcast World, and please always remember to tip your bartenders and your wage staff. I'm Joseph Latinos, reminding you all that Red Skull lives, and look for Bunches of Punches premiering this fall on your local TV.
Nice.
That is good. All
Bunches
right.
of punches.
Right. Man, I would watch that.
I am going to start working on the pilot tonight.
Please do.
So.
Yeah.
bunch of punches. That's just brilliant.
It's like a, an action adventure parody adventure. You know, like a, it's a parody. It's an absolute parody, but it's action adventure. And there's good characters and there's plots, but it's a ridiculous parody of action shows. It's called Bunches of Punches.
It's great. It's like Bunches of Punches. Oh my God. What studio exec would be able to resist that? None, I tell you.